Hello and welcome back to A Pint with Peter. First of all, let me start off by saying apologies for some technical difficulties we had on the last episode. It took us a couple of goes to get the actual content of the episode audible rather than just my intro and outro due to some technical difficulties. But anyway, we're jumping back to the 80s with Peter.
Big thing about 80s music, you had a return to decadence, if you want. Decadence became fashionable, and these movements, they all seem to bloody begin in London, unfortunately. But the idea of decadence was referencing past eras, and it was mimicking the golden eras of the 20th century. Are you with me? I don't know how much history you guys did for GCSE or whatever, but I'm talking here about the Weimar Republic. So does the Weimar Republic mean anything to you? Is that period in German history after the Second World War and into the 20s and into the 30s before the rise of Hitler? But if you look at New Romanticism, that was the historical reference point. Berlin, Weimar Republic, 1920s, 1930s. And I think I finished off last time with this idea of polymorphous perversity, yeah, which is basically a Freudian term. But what you would have seen during the 80s and... It would have begun in my hippie era. You had seeping into even what I would, as a hippie, would have called straight society. You would have had dissolving sexual mores. Do you know what I mean? And what polymorphous perversity is, when you have a baby, for example, because Freud was very much fixated on childhood. As a baby, you don't have any morals, if you want, or sensibilities. You will derive, I wouldn't call it sexual pleasure, but proto-sexual pleasure from objects and so on and so forth. You know, you might even play with your own poo, that kind of thing. Are you with me? And during my lifetime, I've told you before, as a young kid, I remember the curtain twitching for a child who was born out of wedlock, that kind of thing. And certainly homosexuality, you know, bisexuality and so on would have been a taboo subject. And we now live in a much more enlightened era. So as you move through the 60s, I think it would have been a relatively small core of people in the 70s, you know, with liberal, if you want, woke views. In the 70s, it grew. In the 80s, I think all this, what I'm calling polymorphous perversity, gathered pace. And it almost became, if you want, commercialized, if you want. An iconic moment for me, and I guess you'd include this guy in the kind of new romantic thing, was Boy George. When Boy George first appeared, he had national coverage, and people were talking about it in staff rooms and in workplaces and around the water cooler. You know, did you see that? Well, I'm not sure if it was a girl or a boy on Top of the Pops last night, and that was Boy George. And Boy George briefly became iconic. For somebody like, say, Julie's parents, somebody like Boy George would have been just an unbelievable alien. Do you understand what I'm driving at?
Yeah.
With each passing decade, that kind of seepage of, if you want, more decadent ideas it developed, and the restraints experienced by previous generations, you know, the shackles were slipping off. So you had far greater approval of same-sex relationships. What interested me, I did a bit of research, You know, do you know when gay relationships became legal in Scotland and Northern Ireland? Can you guess what year that was? Later than in Britain. Than
I'm going to go 90s.
I'm going to go 2005.
No, 82 it was. Okay. Like, oh. 82. And
Scotland's more progressive than we thought.
Yeah. And
Northern Ireland.
So what you had during the, particularly the new romantic era, there's a lovely picture behind you of that girl. You were much more likely to identify as gay, lesbian or bi. And it was becoming acceptable. Not wholly acceptable, but more acceptable. And they slowly developed... I could spend a whole podcast on this. You had the kind of libertarian cat out the bag of punk. You know, because a lot of... I mean, I was looking at... a few old pictures of punks the other day. I mean, you're talking outrageous, aren't you, really? You're talking outrageous. Yeah, when these people maybe would have worn swastikas and so on, worst case scenario. I mean, you're really quite offensive and deliberately so, whilst at the same time saying it was ironic. I'm not sure. But what you had in the 80s, you had that kind of libertarian punk attitude, but it was fused with a Thatcherite vibe. Because the 80s was the Thatcher era, 79 to 83, 83 to 87, 87 to 91. Pure Thatcher.
I'm going to say it's quite funny how iconic she is in that
pure
way.
Pure Thatcher.
How it is the Thatcherism.
Pure Thatcher. And... I mean, I could talk, obviously, about the miners' strike, which was 40 years ago, much talked about. I could talk to you about the 3 million unemployed at the end of the 70s, blah, blah.
I mean, did it affect anyone you knew? These strikes?
Oh, massive. Also, you had the Falklands. I mean... That's a very good question. I mean, I remember, and excuse me if I'm repeating myself, I remember at the end of the 70s walking through my hometown and seeing, you know, semi-derelict buildings and people looked very much down at heel, and I thought, wow, this is a really tough era. It reminded me of the 1920s or whatever. If you look at the Falklands... For example, very ambivalent. I mean, nobody in my family went to... Well, my sister's husband did, obviously, but the Falklands, for somebody like me, it was quite divisive. So I used to go back to my hometown quite a lot in the early 80s, and I remember a few of the pubs, one pub in particular, where I think one of the proprietor's son or one of the guy's brothers was actually fighting in the Falklands. The whole pub was decked out with Union Jacks, oh. And it would have big, you know, posters in the window, you know, come on our lads, that kind of thing. And I felt ambivalent about it because I've always had a very deep sympathy because of my background for the armed forces. And yet, at the same time, it's all a little bit too jingoistic. Do you know what I mean? Parts of it, you know, that kind
what
of...
Does jingo?
It's that kind of patriotism writ large, where it becomes ridiculous. You know, yeah. John Bull and all that stuff. So I basically kept my mouth shut. I mean, with the miners' strike, I've told you before, I went to gigs at that time. I saw people like Billy Bragg. At that time, playing at the university, and you'd have collecting tins and so on and so forth. Much earlier in that era, I've told you before, it's one couple of times when I ever went on a march for you know, the anti-Nazi League, Rock Against Racism.
Would you have protests against the Falklands?
No.
Our view is like,
no.
Was it our Vietnam
no.
where you had?
No, definitely not. I think most people...
were kind of for it.
Most people accepted that it was a necessary step. You didn't have... I mean, the other thing about we English, I mean, we are, if if you're honest, quite apathetic politically, aren't we? So it was something that was going on, and you did feel that you had to support the troops going over there.
But I feel like ours was the Iraq War.
Yeah,
that would definitely, and that's a much.
And I feel like I was quite influenced by the punk bands, yeah, I listened to.
Yeah.
They were,
yeah,
like, oh, we're only going over there for, yeah, the oil.
Well, I think there's an awful lot of emerging factual evidence indicating what a massive mistake that was, and how somebody like Blair was just pulled into it. Mm. And you know, and this is kind of little England thing. It's like even at the moment with Israel, you know, we're trying to. You know, Britain needs to protest and create a ceasefire. I get a feeling that we're kind of verging on a third world nation now. Nobody's bothered about us. Nobody's bothered too much about our opinion. You know, I don't think we are world leaders anymore. But this Thatcherite vibe, I think you could argue that it was really about greed. It was a greed is good era. And what you had was, it was a dog-eat-dog vibe, and it was all about entrepreneurialism. And, I'll sit on the fence on this one. I'll sit on the fence because around that time, just before I met your mum, I was in another relationship that tanked. I lived in Glossop, and I lived in Stockport, and this woman was on the rebound from a marriage, you know what I'm saying? And I've told you before, she was just incredibly jealous. I'm not pretending I'm perfect. You know, the lady who used to, if I went back to Stafford, would hide my best trousers under the bed and things like that.
I don't know about this,
right? Yeah, it all came to a head. Sure, I'd told you before. Funnily enough, we stopped after work at a Chinese restaurant, and she was there sitting in the CB, the Citroen CB, you know, the little cars they had back then. And I went into this Chinese restaurant. You know what I'm like? I talk to anybody even then. And I obviously talked to the girl behind the counter too much. Yeah, I got back in the car and she just accused me of chatting up this Chinese.
Yeah, I've had girlfriends like
I'm not joking. I mean, I do have a temper, but it's quite hard to rouse it. And she kept nagging at me. And when we got close to the house, I just, I didn't fling the Chinese meal on the dashboard. I just got out the car. I just got out the car and walked away from it.
But when we turn it into a script, Chris, yeah, you did throw the Chinese.
I want to know more about your best trousers being hidden.
Well, why? Well, it's funny you mentioned
this. So he couldn't wear them for the other women.
Because people like Andy and Ollie would say, yeah, Peter, you're always a bit of a clothes source, weren't you? You're always a bit of a vain, narcissistic sod. So that would be hippie-ish, yeah?
For the listener, we're now looking at photos of Peter.
That would be my hippie friends.
Well, first of all, that was Dad's afro.
Yeah. That would be me kind of between hippie and Bowie. You would love that shirt, Russ. It had dogs on it.
Oh, he's there touching a woman then.
Yeah. She was lovely. That's me getting a bit Bowie. Notice the kind of mullet.
That one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you love this one. I don't know if you want to take a picture. That's me. Probably a few months into meeting your mum.
Look at that stash.
That's like a Tom Selleck kind of.
Yeah, it
very much is.
That's the giveaway. But I would have been your age. That would have been me at your age. And you can't see in the picture, but I had a pair of mock snakeskin Cuban-heeled winkle pickers. I had a very elaborate pair of trousers that had pleats up the front. You can't see it in the picture. And that is a type of mohair jacket. So when I first met your mum, Russell, she was
You look quite like David Seaman.
The goalkeeper. Yeah, the goalkeeper.
I was just thinking, I feel like that's an outfit Alex would love me in.
Really? Yeah. But I remember your mum was coming out of quite a difficult marriage, and her husband had moved down south, and she was still living in the marital home, and we went for some dalliance, shall we say, and I left that morning. I left that jacket on the banister.
Ooh, clever move, that.
And her husband came back, and he said, "What's going on?"
Not a clever move.
Saying, what's going on? Are you going out with a punk? Are you going out with a punk? But what I'm driving at is my second best pair of trousers, to answer Chris's question, and to go back to literary references, a massive book and film at the time was Brideshead Revisited, Evelyn Waugh, which took you back to that between the war period with very rich, decadent people. And my second best pair of trousers were actually the bottom half of a tuxedo. It was a pair of dress trousers that had a lovely silk strip down each leg. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So that was my second best. By the way, Russell, my girlfriend in Glossop, she probably did have reason to be worried, to be very frank. But
we aren't perfect.
But again, during that era, people were much more inclined towards style, glamour, something fizzy and happy. I mean, the Weimar Republic, you can check this out in Berlin. The leading reference for this is the movie Cabaret. You watch the movie Cabaret, I think it's a stage show in London at this moment. You're talking... decadence and depravity that even now would seem quite extreme. Berlin in the 1920s, apparently it consumed 80% of the cocaine in Germany. You had, men dressed as women dressed as men, blah blah. Check the movie out.
Have you seen Babylon Berlin?
Similar thing. No.
Very similar vibe of that. It's about the police force in Berlin, kind of in that
during
time.
That era.
Yeah,
oh, that's interesting.
But there's all that aspect of it, like the clubs and stuff.
I was thinking,
it's very good.
What's it called? Atomic Blonde. I think it's a bit more of an over the top.
Atomic Blonde's more 80s, isn't it?
I'm sure the Berlin Wall's still in it.
Yeah, we're talking about like the 20s.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but the vibe. In the 80s was from the 20s.
There we go. We're linking up.
So, it's a. What you had a return to style, a return to glamour. And what's interesting, if you go back to the development of the film industry in the States, my mother would have grown up with the cult of celebrity. Do you know what I mean? She would have, I'm not going to name the names, but all the big stars, the screen stars of that era. During the punk era, it was actually a slogan, no more heroes. Nobody, no matter who, it was good in a way, no matter who do you think you are, just because you're rich, just because you think you're famous or whatever. I don't give a toss. It's quite a healthy attitude in a way.
Yeah, definitely.
But in the end, it's quite oppressive. So what you had during the 80s, you had a restructuring of the celebrity culture thing. Suddenly it was okay to be a celebrity. And you had, obviously, the big clubs in New York, but in the 80s you had the exclusive. It started off pretty tatty. You can see from that picture behind you, that I think is a still from a club called the Beetroot. Quite clever, isn't it? La Beetroot. But eventually you had music moved away from sweaty pubs and sleazy back rooms, and people wanted more sophistication. And eventually, I think it came to a climax in the 90s, you had massive super clubs, you know, the kind of things they would have had in Ibiza and so on. And again, all these movements, you're basically, well, I think some people sneak under the radar. You're talking about your under 25s, aren't you? I think it's critical. I mean, that they'd seen through the punk boredom, and they needed to be inspired. So it was about flash, it was about cash, it was about image, it was about high theatre, it was about camp. Think Boy George and people like that. So you were talking bigger, grander, more expensive. And putting it at ground level, a lot of individuals during that time, and again, I think in some ways it was positive, instead of feeling despondent and pissed off, a lot of people, particularly if they had an entrepreneurial bone in their body, they would try things. You know what I mean? They would. I went to London during the 80s, where quite a number of individuals I'd known from college had set up there. I don't forget, that was in the eras of squats. You weren't paying £1,000 a bloody week for it to rent a two-bed flat kind of thing. People were, oh, I'm going to try and be a video maker. Huh. Oh, I'm going to try and be a record producer. And, oh, I'm, do you know what I mean? It was, yeah. From that perspective, it was absolutely fantastic. But the dark side of it was, I'm going to make loads of money if I can. And I don't care whose head I tread on. It was that kind of vibe too. And quite a lot of our relatives on, you know, the side I'm talking about, were infected by it. And they're still infected by it. It's all about labels and having a flash car and pure 80s. Whereas people like your mum and I, rightly or wrongly, we've still got that hippie kind of liberal vibe going on.
So did you not have any failed businesses?
Do you know, it's a funny one, that, because I was, as you know, my best friend was in the music biz in A&R, and I think I told you in my last podcast, he suggested to me I could go and, you know, jack in anything in education and start up there. And I sometimes wish I had, in a funny sort of way. But it's going back to responsibility and, you know, having, you know, the prospect of having kids and so on and so forth. When we finish this, if you go and check Germany in the 1920s, and this is a whole new theme, if you take a society and shred it and destroy it and rip it up, give it time, when that society rebuilds, you get some incredible innovation. I mean, you guys are both interested in art. I mean, during the 20s, you had Bauhaus. Have you ever seen, you know, the furniture from that era, the buildings? You had the paintings of, I said to Russell when he went to Berlin, the paintings of George Grosz. And the design of the time was very much straight-lined, geometrical stuff. And what I was going to move on to, I think it might have to be the next session. After Joy Division morphed into New Order, and I haven't got a lot of New Order stuff, but just look at those album designs. That's pure, kind of, you know, the straight lines and the geometrical stuff. If I had more,
well, it was quite modern in a way.
That's the whole point. This is 100 years ago. The Bauhaus was essentially 100 years ago, but the design is still
almost like a classic timeless.
Classic and timeless. Yeah, that's what they. That was the last offering of Ian Curtis.
Love Will Tear Us.
Great, what a great. This was really big selling. Love Will Tear. What a great song.
Yeah, it is a good song.
Love Will Tear Us Apart. You had. See, what interests me, because I know you guys like your history, you had all that decadence going on in Germany, but of course the mainstream objected to it, and you had Nazism coming in, didn't you? It was an insult to German feeling. And do you know anything about the Degenerate Art exhibition?
No.
Well, it's basically some of the stuff in that art exhibition would be worth millions now. And Goebbels went around it and they destroyed it all.
Bloody Nazis.
Yeah, bloody Nazis. I mean, Joy Division, though, they began as being punkish and they changed into different moods, different textures, and they developed into a band that would have led on to the techno dance explosion, didn't they, in the Manchester scene. Okie doke. Do you want to call a halt there on New Order? Final thing, I will start next time talking about true love and talking about kids and talking about Russia. But what you need to know is, unquestionably, the 80s opened up a much wider scene. Writers, photographers, fashion designers, artists, filmmakers. And you had, I think, which is a real big mindset now, you had a trend for reinvention. Do you know what I mean? You could reinvent yourself. And for the first time, nobody wanted to be ordinary. And I think that's a really crippling thing even now, don't you? I do. People, I think it destroys you from the inside. If you go around psychologically thinking, oh, yeah, I want to be that, or I didn't do that, I think you've got to accept yourself as you are. Does that make sense to you?
It does, yeah.
I don't know. I personally think ordinary is a new norm. You just see these teenagers and they all look the same.
It was even like that for
us growing up. Yeah. As soon as we had long hair and we were a bit different, it's like you get, what's the word?
Categorised.
No, pushed aside, like, oh no, you're against the norm.
That's a really interesting one, yeah, because don't ask me why, but on my phone I get this series of video clips. I think it's a plot. I think it's one of these robot created things. It's called "Where Is This? Where Is This? Gorgeous Girls." And what it is? It's 5 minute clips of girls mainly clubbing in places like Liverpool and London and Manchester, and their attire. Particularly if you're from, a more oppressed society, you know, it must be, wow, your eyes would be on stalks. But what strikes me is they are indeed very similar. That's where it gets interesting. You've got this kind of axis of, you know, the polarity of, oh, I think of myself as being very individualistic and even unique, and yet you're not.
But is that not the case for kind of every generation in a way?
I think so.
If we were our age, back when we were like had long hair, would we not think, oh, they all look the same?
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, I've got to finish on this one because it links in the kind of.
Before you move on, Dave, I do just kind of want to say, like, yeah, if you put it into perspective. Because going to a rock gig, I'm dressed the same as everyone else.
Yeah.
And I think I'm different. Exactly. But then you put me with that scenario, I just look the same.
Yeah. That's an interesting one. Right. So we'll draw a close, if that's okay. Yep.
Did you have one more thing to say? Is that later?
Well, I was going to interject during that time in London. You had these very, very exclusive, if you want, new romantic clubs opening up. And they were very flamboyant and very stylish. And the cool was paramount. And, I suppose she's your auntie, isn't she? Auntie Lisa and Adrian. I remember them going down to London. I'm not sure if it was Billy's or La Beetroot or The Blitz. I think it was The Blitz. They went for what nowadays you'd call a weekend away. And these clubs, like The Blitz, Boy George, I think he would have been a hat check boy back then, that kind of thing. They would have a door policy. And I remember reading an account of how Mick Jagger turned up at one of these really trendy new romantic clubs and they turned him away.
Oh.
And of course, that's great publicity.
Well, a club did it in Manchester, didn't they, to Justin Bieber?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's closed down now. Maybe go show it didn't work. But yeah, they turned Justin Bieber away.
But if you, I don't know how long later it was, David Bowie came along and he was completely mobbed. And that maybe is what I can talk about next time, amongst other things. Bowie and Roxy Music. You can see from that picture there, they're all Bowie albums. That's the lobby of the early Blitz Club. But, you know, you love this one. Your Auntie Lisa and Adrian being Manchester trendies, they actually managed to get into one of these clubs. And they were completely gold-shouldered.
Oh,
you have to
really?
Ask her about it. Yeah, it's what's called the, you know, being cool was paramount. It's what's called it during the day, the silent shrug. Yeah, it's that kind of thing, yeah. And you can ask her, if you see her, how they got on in that club, because it was a horrible experience, because they weren't wearing the right
shirt
or pair of trousers or the right makeup. They were getting, and that's... You see, I don't think that would have ever happened during the punk era, certainly not the hippie era. And that's why I want to finish on that note. You had that kind of rising exclusivity, that horrible kind of snobbishness. Do you know what I mean? And it was all about, with the music, it was really, to a very great extent, how you looked.
I think the term we used growing up was you were a wannabe.
Yeah,
If Chris turned up in the wrong type of jeans, like, oh, you're just a wannabe mosh.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, you know, I'm into language. I was doing a bit of research yesterday about punk, and again, it just turns up on my phone. There's a picture of about 30 or 40 punks outside a record store in Bristol, and a few people were writing in saying, oh, no, that's not that's 1982. Punk was dead then. These people are postcard punks.
Oh.
Do you know what I mean? How in every era you've got people who, they're not really in the vibe, but they're kind of weekend people. Because apparently in London, well, not just London, certain cities, you know what tourists are like, you could actually make a living.
Well, you've got the Camden punks, don't you? Yeah.
Dressing up in that kind of style, and you can make some money from it, you know. Anyway, let's call a halt.
That.
And we'll leave it there for this week. I do hope you enjoyed this episode, but for me, I can't wait to hear about Peter's adventures in Russia. I think that's going to be absolutely fascinating. And where do you think Peter's best trousers were hidden? Let us know. Of course, you can always join in the conversation with us and find us on Twitter at @apintwithpeter, or you can always email us apintwithpeter@gmail.com. Anyway, I guess, in the words of Russell, on to the next one.